Today's Teisho is on case 47 in the Book of Serenity, Zhao Zhu's Cypress Tree. Introduction. The cypress tree in the yard, the wind-blown flag on the pole, it's like one flower revealing a boundless spring, like one drop telling of the water of the whole ocean. The ancient Buddhas, born periodically, go far beyond the ordinary current, not falling into words and thought. How can you understand verbally? Case. A monk asked Zhao Zhu, "What is the living meaning of Chan, of Zen?" Zhao Zhu said, "The cypress tree in the yard." Verse. The bank eyebrows lined with snow, the river eyes contain autumn, the ocean mouth drums waves, the boat tongue rides the current. The ability to quell disorder, the strategy for great peace, old Zhao Zhu, old Zhao Zhu, stirring up the monasteries, never yet stopping. Uselessly expending effort, still the cart is made to fit the groove. Originally without ability, still it fills the ravines and the gullies. I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning, and I want to say how happy I am to see all of you, every one of you. I know that some of you have been struggling with various things in your life, and at least one person has survived a car accident, and I'm so happy is able to be here today. And other people have had other difficulties that I know about, and I'm just very glad. I'm glad that you're safe. I'm glad you're still alive. I'm glad you're here. I'm glad we can sit together on this Saturday morning, this beautiful Saturday morning. When you think that just a few events, one way or another, might make that impossible, it made me realize this morning as I was sitting here just how precious it is to be here with each of you. It's just really wonderful. Many of us have practiced together at Sesshin. We've sat for a certain amount of time in pain together. We've sat in the cold. We've sat in the heat. And we've sat in the beautiful radiance of awakened mind together. And it's just so precious. It's so wonderful. And I'm glad you're all okay, and I'm glad you're here. Thank you very much for coming. So the subject of this koan, or the main figure in this koan, is the great Master Zhao Zhu. Some of you, many of you, know about Zhao Zhu, but for those who don't, let me say that Zhao Zhu was possibly the greatest Zen master in the Tang Dynasty. Really an extraordinary person. You know, it's quite rare for undergraduates to be able to do Zazen, because most people who are, say, 17, 18, 19 years old are just discovering what it's like to be a self. And it's rather rare for a person of that age to go beyond the self and encounter something bigger. Most people that age don't necessarily want to do that. And some people are incapable, many people, are really psychologically at that stage in their lives incapable of that kind of an experience. So as you know, we have a beginner's night on Monday and a beginner's night on Friday, and many, many people come and they want to experiment with meditation. They're excited about it, and it's wonderful. I'm glad they come. And a fair number of them try it and don't come back. Maybe later in their lives, when they're a little more mature, they will come back. But it doesn't surprise me necessarily, because it's quite rare for people who are, as I say, 17, 18, 19, to be able to encounter big mind on the cushion. A little too caught up in just experiencing small mind at that age. So Zhao Zhu was quite an exceptional person in any age. He would be exceptional now, and he was exceptional in the Tang Dynasty when he lived. He had his first great awakening experience when he was about 18 years old. And it was quite a big encounter with awakened mind. Quite an extraordinary experience. That usually doesn't happen. Most people begin to have those kinds of experiences after 5, 6, maybe 7 years of practice. But Zhao Zhu, for some reason, had very powerful kensho, very powerful awakening experience when he was about 18 years old. And some people, after having an experience like that, might, especially in the United States today, would write a book and go out on the talk show circuit and that sort of thing, be on television, Larry King Live, and the secret of the moment, you know, it would be that kind of thing. Tell us about the secret of the moment, Zhao Zhu. Sure, Larry. But Zhao Zhu didn't do that. Zhao Zhu said, what is this enlightened mind? What is this thing? What has just happened to me? So he wanted to know more. And he decided to go and study with a great Zen master. Nanchuan. And Nanchuan and Zhao Zhu were very famous in the Tang Dynasty as the two great Zen practitioners. Nanchuan was quite a bit older than Zhao Zhu. And Zhao Zhu studied with Nanchuan until Nanchuan died. And then Zhao Zhu was asked to take over the temple. Remember, he'd had his first awakening at 18. Now he was in his 60s. And Nanchuan was dead, and everybody said, well, are you going to take over Nanchuan's temple? And Zhao Zhu said, wait a minute, I'm still learning, still learning. See, I just think that's so remarkable. See, I want to experience big mind more, want to experience awakened mind even more. And he had many awakening experiences. So he went out on the road in China, and he went all over China, to temples all over China. And in those days, and in China right up until the Cultural Revolution, it was possible for any monk or nun to travel all over the country and stay in public temples. For a long time in Chinese history, the Chinese people valued enlightenment very highly. And they created a whole system in which it was possible for men and women to pursue awakening. So Zhao Zhu traveled all over China and met many deeply awakened teachers. And many of his encounters with teachers and students are recorded in the koan collections that we have now. So Zhao Zhu is supposed to have lived to be 120. So that's supposedly so. Could be true. Apparently he created the Mu Koan, the U Koan, when he was about 100, something like that. Pretty good, huh? So this is a koan from later part of his life. A monk asked Zhao Zhu what is the meaning of Chan? What is the meaning of Zen? What is the meaning of Buddhism? Zhao Zhu said, the cypress tree in the yard. So I hope you have seen a cypress tree that's an evergreen tree, beautiful evergreen tree. It grows very wide, very tall, very beautiful. This must have been in the courtyard of the temple where Zhao Zhu was staying. So this is one very famous koan, one of the most famous koans, and it's just a wonderful koan. I hope that we will have the chance to do it together. I would love to know. I would love to know what your cypress tree is. You know, I can't wait to find out. But this koan's a beautiful explanation of the whole of Zen practice. Really, just beautiful expression of the whole of Zen practice. What is Chan? What is Zen? Cypress tree in the courtyard. I was asked to give, every semester I'm asked to give a guest lecture in the Eastern Religions course. The religion department has a little section in the course on Zen, on Chan. And they invite me every semester to come and give a lecture on Zen, Chan. And I always give the lecture. I'm always thrilled to give the lecture. Usually people are very receptive. But sometimes it's interesting, Buddhism is a strange thing in a lot of ways. It's rather different from conventional religions. And in fact, when I deliver the lecture, I always start by saying that I don't really think Buddhism is a religion in the Western sense, or a philosophy in the Western sense. And I usually talk about the fact that we understand religion as being divine revelation that gets written down in scriptures, holy scriptures. And you study the scriptures, and that's how you get to the truth. And I think that's true for pretty much every religion I know of except Buddhism, if Buddhism even is a religion. And it's true, there are sutras in Buddhism. But I don't think they serve the same function as a scripture. If you think about it, Islam has the Quran, Christianity has its Bible, Judaism has its Bible, and half of the Christian Bible is the Jewish Bible. More than half, as a matter of fact. The Hindu tradition has the Vedas and Upanishad. So all of these different traditions, the Sikhs have holy scriptures and so on. I point out whenever I give this lecture that Buddhism is really, the Buddha didn't achieve awakening by studying scriptures. He didn't pore over the Vedas or the Upanishads and say, I have it, now I see. He sat on a cushion and did the bhavana, meditation, what we call meditation. And that was his path to truth, and that's the road he taught. So that's rather distinctive, I think. And I also point out that Buddhism is not a philosophy. Many people read books on Buddhism and they treat it as a philosophy. So they'll read the Diamond Sutra and there's a statement in there where the Buddha says, emptiness is form and form is emptiness. And if it's you could sit out in your chair in your room and you could lean back and look at the ceiling and think, okay, form is that, what does that mean? What could that mean? You could think, maybe it is empty. Form is empty, You try to think it through. But, that would be a complete waste of time. And in fact, the Buddha actually said that philosophy was a waste of time. He actually said that. He said that in his day in India, there were many philosophers. And they were ready to argue about anything, as in Greek tradition, And the Buddha said, don't even bother to talk to those people, because, you know, you'll argue endlessly and nothing will be changed. Nothing will be changed. And actually, the Buddha wasn't particularly interested in what we would call religion. You know, he was not in favor of making offerings to the gods. He didn't do rituals. You know, this wasn't of any interest to him at all. And actually, he said, you know, this is not particularly helpful. So, you know, whenever I explain this to people, usually a lot of people in the audience are interested because they hadn't really thought about Buddhism this way or Zen this way. It's not a philosophy, not a religion. Well, what is it? And I usually say it's a art of consciousness, transforming your consciousness. And usually that goes pretty well. But this time it didn't go so well. Every once in a while, you know, people feel a little threatened by this way of starting my talk. I don't design it to be threatening. I'm really just trying to tell the truth as I see it. But on occasion, I have had people who seem very troubled by what I have to say. So I know that I used to be invited down to the College of New Jersey to give a talk on Zen too, and they teach a class on Buddhism in their philosophy department. So when I talked about the fact that Buddhism isn't a religion and isn't a philosophy, and I said, you know, actually the Buddha didn't like philosophy very much, I could see the chair of the philosophy department didn't look very happy, you know. And he didn't invite me back, you know, as a matter of fact. So that has happened to me, you know. And also, you know, people who might have dearly loved their religion, and there's nothing wrong with that, might feel very threatened by, say, a tradition that says, you know, truth really isn't in the scriptures. Truth is really in your own mind. You know, that could be threatening to people. So I don't really know the motives of the questioners on this particular day, but they were, you know, there's different kinds of questions. When you say something to somebody, that you can get different kinds of responses. So sometimes you can say something to somebody and there's a genuinely, there's a question that comes out of real confusion or interest, you know. And then there's a question that is a friendly question. It's sometimes designed to help you deliver your talk better. So sometimes I've given talks and friends I know have asked me an easy question because they know I left something out, you know, and they want to help me along. So they'll say, what about this? And I'll go, oh yes, thank you, I forgot all about that. I'll talk about that. So those are like, there's curious questions, there's friendly questions, and then there's what you might call unfriendly questions. And those are questions that are trying to poke holes in your argument or give you a hard time. So the questions from these two young men seem to be somewhat in the category of unfriendly questions, because they sort of cut me off in the middle of my presentation. And one of the questions had to do with, one of the questioners had formed the opinion that Zen was all about detachment and negativity. I don't know where he had gotten. It's not so strange that he might think this is true, right? It worked like this. He stuck up his hand and he said, what about emotions? What do Buddhists think of emotions? And I said something like, well, you know, they have them, you know, and it's an important part of life. And he said, well, what about love? So what about love? It was a little bit, as I say, accusatory. And I said, well, Buddhists love love. And I said, actually, a Buddha is 100% love. But they had formed the idea that Buddhism was about detachment. He said, well, so what about detachment? So what about love? And I said, I love love. Buddhists love love.
And Buddhas are love. And he said, well, what about detachment? And I said, who said anything about, I've been talking, I said, who said anything about detachment? Zen in particular, and Buddhism in general, are often thought to be about detachment. So, if you know anything about the life of monks and nuns, a monk or a nun basically have to leave their families, and they even give up their names, right? They give their names up, and they shave their heads, and they enter a monastery, and they wear these clothes, different kind of clothes, very plain, and they live lives of great simplicity. I know that I've met monks who literally have nothing of their own, except like their robes. They have no personal property. There are monks and nuns in the world who have slept on their tatami mat. That's the only thing that's theirs, a tatami mat and their robes and maybe a blanket or two. Right? And their whole lives are lived with that kind of simplicity. Right? I've known such people. This is like a path of renunciation. Right? You give up your personal life, enter a monastery, and so on. And so, the guy's question was not so crazy. He thinks that Zen is about detachment. Buddhism is about detachment. In fact, if you read books on Buddhism, it'll often say, it's important to have detachment, right? Detachment. You look at the life of a nun or a monk, and it seems to be a life of detachment. And also with Zen practice itself, you could understand this as being about detachment, right? So, when we sit on the cushion, if you focus on your breath, after a while, everything sort of, all the things around you become distant. Right? If you're really focusing on your breath, and you're really concentrating, sensory inputs tend to become very unimportant. When you're sitting on the cushion, you're in deep samadhi, deep concentration. You might not feel your body very much. You might not pay much attention to thoughts in your head. And it's like the world sort of disappears. And of course, when you're in deep mushin, deep u-shin, the world does indeed disappear, right? Everything disappears. So when you look at your mind, it's blank and dark. So it's possible to think that Buddhism is about renunciation and detachment and saying goodbye to the world, right? Saying goodbye to the world. And I think that these two young men had formed this opinion, that Buddhism was about like an anti-life philosophy. And this is widely believed. This is widely believed, and you'll hear this claim from people in particular who aren't especially sympathetic to Buddhism, but you'll even hear it from people who think they're Buddhists. And I remember as a little boy, one of my first encounters with Buddhism was I looked in an almanac. I think it was an almanac. Information Please Almanac, I think is what it was called. And I was looking up all the world's religions, and they had a little statement about the history of each of the world's religions, and they gave sort of like the basic philosophy and so on. And I remember reading the one on Buddhism, and it basically said, Buddhists strive to enter the void. The void, life is suffering, and then you enter the void, right? That's Buddhism. And it's like, that's a hell of a note, as they say in English. So it's like, so you're first you're in pain, and then you're dead, right?
Now there's 500 million Buddhists in the world, so you have to say, what could have attracted them to such a philosophy? Right? First you're in pain and then you're dead. You know, so I can't wait to be dead, right? That's the idea. The void. So this is widely thought to be the case. And as I say, there are even people who think that they're Buddhists who imagine that this is what the Dharma is all about. But that's a confusion, and it's actually an understandable confusion. Because when you think along those lines, you have mixed up the method from the goal. You've mixed up the method with the goal. There's the idea that Buddhism is about the void is not so crazy, because of course Lord Buddha taught the importance of shunyata, emptiness, right? I mean, he talked a lot about emptiness, and indeed the practice of Zen itself requires that you do certain things that might look like renunciation. So for example, if you sat here this morning, you had to get up early, you had to set the clock early, you didn't get to sleep those extra hours. You got up and you came in here and you sat down in a dark room. It was a little cold today because they're still working on the, thermostat. And by spring, probably they'll have it worked out. So basically, we sit here and it's silent. There's no discussion, no activity. It's possible to form the opinion that this is about renunciation. See, we renounced morning television. We renounced Dunkin' Donuts. We are detached from whatever. And so it's possible to form that opinion. It's not an unreasonable opinion, because actually the method does involve something like giving up, something like emptiness. That's the method. The method. But it's important not to confuse the method with the goal. And ultimately, method and goal are not as different as they seem to say common sense or might seem initially. But they're quite different in an important way. You could think about what we're doing as deconditioning. What we're doing is, in Zen practice, is like deconditioning. So my feeling is that, especially in the modern world, people suffer from an extraordinary overload of information. If you look at an issue like global warming, for example, if you just try to educate yourself about global warming, it's possible to reach a point at which you can't make up your mind about whether it's real or not, because there's just so much information. Now, I'm pretty convinced that global warming is real, but if you're just moving through all the information on this, you could actually find yourself unable to reach any kind of decision at all, because there really are studies that suggest that this is just a periodic fluctuation that has very little to do with CO2. There was an article in the paper the other day in the New York Times that said that apparently in a recent ice age, when they go into they dig into the ice cores are loaded with CO2. And so the researchers said, well, this was a period of high CO2, and yet it was an ice age. How can this be? We thought CO2 made things warmer. So this is a very crucial issue confronting us, and yet there's so much information. We're bombarded with information. It becomes very hard to know what to do, how to act. And this is so true with so many things, even commonplace things. A number of years ago, the newspapers came out with a story that said that vitamin E was like a surefire cure for, if you take vitamin E, you'll never get cancer, right? It's like, this is it, the magic bullet, right? So I myself went out and started taking vitamin E every day, right?
And there's another
beta carotene, right? They said, oh, beta carotene, we've got it. You know, the cure for cancer, beta carotene. Okay, so I went and bought my beta carotene, right?
And taking beta carotene every day, vitamin E every day, thinking, okay, this is it. You know. A lot of people in my family have had cancer, so you know, I'm always on the lookout for like anti-cancer things, broccoli, things like that. So I'm taking my vitamin E, I'm taking my beta carotene, and then one day I open the paper and it says, whatever you do, don't take that beta carotene, you know. It's terrible. It could cause cancer, it said, you know. So this is like the modern world, right? It's like sensory overload, you know. When I was a college student, I went to college. I was a very naive person. I had a very sheltered life growing up on military bases. And I had a military haircut when I arrived at college, like my dad, you know. And my roommate was like this swinging dude, you know. He had long hair. And he was having a joint. He liked to have his afternoon, you know, tokes. So I didn't know, should I try marijuana or not, you know? And there were certain people who, you know, like my dad said, you know, it's against the law, young man, you know? So that was his opinion. And then I ran into people who said, you know, try it, man, you'll love it, you know, it's great. I read studies that said it impairs your memory, you know. I can't remember those studies right now, but there are such studies, as I recall. So, you know, should you do it or not? And just like a range of opinions. And this goes on and on. There's just like we're overwhelmed with viewpoints, recommendations. Everybody has advice for us about how to live. You know, it's a little bit overwhelming. And let's face it, not everybody who's trying to convince us of something has our well-being at heart, right? I mean, basically, probably eating a Big Mac every day would not be good for you, right? But people want to sell you a Big Mac every day, you know. So in this kind of a climate, which is really characteristic of like the modern world, but it's always been the case, right? It's always been sort of like this with human beings. You can get very, very confused very, very fast. And you can wake up one day and just say, how did I wind up like this? You know, how did I wind up with a drug problem? Or how did I wind up as an alcoholic? Or how did I wind up in such an unhappy relationship with somebody I once wanted to spend my life with, right? It's very easy for these things to happen, right? Now, you know, in this kind of a world where you're constantly bombarded with information and everybody has a different opinion, some people respond to this complexity by just getting totally lost and sort of losing control of their lives, right? They just lose control. They're just pulled this way and that way and this way and that way. And this is how they live, right? And at some point in their lives, they wake up one day and say, I hate my life. I don't like myself. You know, and I can't stop being what I am. You know, and this is millions, millions and millions of people. And then there are people who say, okay, I need to know the truth, right? There's got to be one truth. You know, and they find a truth. It could be the sacred book. It could be the Communist Manifesto. You know, it could be Milton Friedman. Whatever. You know, this is it. This is the truth. And they just say, "This is. I'm holding on to this for dear life. This is going to take me through all this chaos. You know, and I'm. This is it." Right? So those are ways to live. And then there's the Zen way. And the Zen way is based upon the idea that there's a kind of natural human condition, and that all of this culture that's swirling around us is a little bit unnatural. And the way to respond to all of this confusion is to just go back to our fundamental state, which is a Buddha, which is enlightenment. See? And that's what the Buddha discovered, right? India, in the time of the Buddha, 2,500 years ago, wasn't really that different. It's naive to think that it was a simpler time. The world was swirling with different values. Violence was everywhere. People were exploiting people. There was the 5th century BCE version of the Big Mac, I'm sure, you know. So basically, Buddha said, look, I'm just going to practice this bhavana, this yoga of samadhi. I'm going to go deep into the deepest core of myself and see if I can find the truth there. See? And he did, or he said he did. He said, I have found the deathless, what he called the deathless, this enlightenment, okay? And boundless, endless compassion. He said, human beings are fundamentally compassion. That's what the Buddha said. Human beings are fundamentally compassion. Birthless and deathless compassion. So this is the if you happen to walk the path of Chan, of Zen, this is your approach, right? We don't have a book that we pull out and say, this is the truth, this is it. And we don't just follow any current that sweeps us along. What we do is we sit on the cushion and we go deep in ourselves. And basically we say to Dunkin' Donuts on Saturday morning, no donut for me today. You know? We keep the TV off because you've come to sit. We sit in a dark room because there's not too much sensory stimulation in a dark room. It's got to be pretty quiet. It doesn't have to be perfectly quiet, but it has to be reasonably quiet. And we focus on the breath. Little by little, all of these pestering thoughts, all of this cultural conditioning begins to recede, and we begin to experience the primal beauty of pure awareness itself, pure awareness itself. And in those moments, we are Buddha. We are awake. You know, and there can be little moments of awakening or big moments of awakening. See? And then, you know, then it's like a purification. One way to think about it, this is like purification. If you you go to the doctor and the doctor says you have high cholesterol, right? The one thing you could do is to continue to eat the way you've been eating and get no exercise and so on. You could certainly do that, right? That would be possible. But it's possible too that what you could say is, all right, I'm going to clean up my act. I'm going to clean up my act. I'm going to clean up my life. Now, I'm going to stop eating Big Macs and high carbohydrate foods. And I'm going to start eating carrots and celery. I'm going to eat 3 meals a day instead of 20 meals a day. You know? I'm going to lay off milkshakes and so on. You know? And you could get up one day and you could have breakfast, simple breakfast of oatmeal, some fruit. Sounds delicious, right? No coffee today for me. Just a little orange juice. You know, then you could have lunch, and you could have rice and lentil soup, a vegetable. You know. And for dinner, you could have tofu and miso soup. Maybe miso soup, that'd be delicious, right? And rice, brown rice. And you would get healthier and healthier, right? Now somebody could come along and say, look at your life. You know, you're not having those Big Macs. I mean, this is a life of renunciation. This is why you're turning your back on all those rich experiences, right? And that's maybe so, right? No steak tartare, you know, no. Okay. But you'd be healthier, and you'd probably be happier. It's like simplicity. There's much to recommend simplicity. You know, perhaps you've noticed that, you know, if you go home, and you could even do an experiment, you know. After we sit, we usually have tea and a cookie, right? We do two periods of meditation or three periods of meditation. We sit down on the cushion, we enter Mushin, or we enter deep samadhi, thoughts come and go, etc. Everything disappears after a while, the bell rings, and in comes the tea and the cookie. You drink the tea, eat the cookie. It's so good, right? Really, it's like people have even come up to me and said, "What is that tea?" You know, or these cookies, they're so delicious. It's like it's a famous ancient Chinese recipe called Pepperidge Farm. Pepperidge Farm. Now you could, after that, you know, you could do an experiment. You can go home, turn on the tube, and put on the stereo, you know, put a bunch of cookies on the plate, right? You know, have a mug of tea, you know, sit there and watch TV and listen to the stereo and eat those cookies and just see what they taste like. But they don't, they have no taste, probably, right? And the more you eat, the less taste they have, right? You can wash down the mug of tea, the big gulp of tea. So there's something wrong with that way of life. And to say, I'm going to have a little tiny, I'm going to sit in silence for an hour, and then I'm going to have a little tiny bit of tea and one little cookie. You know, it's like, in terms of quality of experience, the quality of the experience is so much greater when you simplify, right? And this is what Buddhism is all about. It's all about this. The quality becomes greater when you simplify. And now, this wouldn't work if people were basically not Buddha. See, this wouldn't work if people were basically not enlightened. But fortunately, they are. And so when you just slow down, when you just calm down, when you take away the sensory inputs, automatically people begin to feel better. They feel better, and they feel happier and more connected, and the mind becomes bright. The dark mind becomes dark, and the dark mind becomes bright. Right? It's beautiful, beautiful. And it's just, we're naturally Buddhists. We just get a little confused, right? It's like we're Buddhas who can invent TV. Or Buddhas who can invent alcohol, automobile, you know, movies, and so on. And we get a little caught up in our magic show, right? A little bit too caught up in the illusions we've created. And they're expressions of our creativity, they're expressions of our potential. And when they're beautiful, they're beautiful. You know, you look at a beautiful painting, by Cezanne. Look at something by Cezanne, and you just think, oh, that's breathtaking. So at its best, you know, that capacity to create these beautiful images is wonderful, but it runs away with us, right? And we get a little confused and we forget that we're Buddhas. So we have to go on a diet, right? We have to go on a kind of a input diet, mental diet. And we don't eat the Big Macs. We sit in a quiet room in the dark, and the mind begins to return to its natural state, just like, going out to when you're, I like to hike, you know. I like to go out. I don't get to do it that much anymore, but when you've hiked 8 miles, anything tastes delicious. You know what I mean? It's just the simplest food can taste absolutely delicious if you're hungry enough. You know, and the most wonderful food in the world has no taste if you're, you know, spoiled or you're distracted or you're fearful and angry. You know, and you go out on the trail and you hike for a week. I've done that many times in my life. You know, very simple food. You know, delicious. At the end of it, I get on the scale and I've lost
15 pounds or 10 pounds, something like that, feel better, healthier. That's not world denial. It's not saying no to the world. It's living skillfully, living skillfully. The method in Buddhism is to enter emptiness. Emptiness. And you know, the word nirvana in Buddhism means to blow out, like blowing out a candle. But what gets extinguished in nirvana is not the world, it's your illusions, it's your fears, it's your destructive habits, it's your bad conditioning. Right? That's what gets wiped away. You know, when the Buddha had his Daikensho experience, his Great Awakening experience, he didn't disappear, right? After having the Great Awakening, the Buddha didn't vanish into heaven, right? That's the end of him. You know, he's gone. He lived for another 40, 45 years. He ate dinner, you know, at noon every day. He spent his whole life trying to help other people, free them from their, help them overcome their suffering and unhappiness. He was cold in the winter and warm in the summer. And he himself said, you know, one of the marks of enlightenment is joy. And he said, there's two kinds of enlightenment. There's enlightenment in which you're sitting on a cushion, you know, and there's enlightenment when you're walking around and you're in the marketplace, you know. So this is not about saying no. If anybody says that, I understand from the Information Please Almanac, that Buddhism is about the void. First you suffer, then you die. Say, that's actually not an accurate understanding. Right? Not like that. And there are people who say they're Buddhists who think that's true. A monk asked Zhao Zhu, what is the meaning of Chan, Buddhism? What's this all about? Is this about escape? Is this about transcendence? Is this about liberation from the toils of rebirth? Zhao Zhu said, my dear friend, cypress tree in the courtyard, ever the beautiful evergreen tree, is your true self. And there must have been a tree right out there. So, you want to know what Buddhism is all about? That is your true self. This is your true, this world is your true self. This world is heaven itself. And if you say, well, it doesn't feel like heaven all the time, please keep sitting. Please keep sitting. The cypress tree in the courtyard. The bank eyebrows lined with snow. The river eyes contain autumn. The ocean mouth drums waves. The boat tongue rides the current. What is this about? These koans, you know, they're so... The bank eyebrows lined with snow. The river eyes contain the autumn. The ocean mouth... What are they talking about? What the heck? Well, what he's saying is, you know, this world is your true face. See? The hills lined with snow are your eyebrows. The rivers are your eyes. The ocean is your mouth. The boat is your tongue. This world is your true self. And please enjoy your wonderful true self. That's why we came here today to practice. And I hope that's why you'll come back.